In a time when people traveled the world quickly by jet, we've gotten used to diseases ending up in places where they were not originally found, but no planes were apparently involved in bringing a potentially deadly fungus to the Pacific Northwest. Cryptococcus gottii, yeah, it's a mouthful, is normally a creature of the tropics, but it is present in places from Oregon on northward, far from its original home. Human activities and acts of nature appear to have played a part in the migration. That's the finding of research out of the Translational Genomics Research Institute in Arizona, generally called TGen. David Engelthaler is the principal author of the recently published research and our guest from TGen. Hi, David.
Good morning, Jeffrey.
Good to have you here. What's the general kind of work at TGen?
So TGen is a nonprofit research institute, and our focus is the translational part, which is translating new discovery into new drugs, new diagnostics, new analytical tools to really improve human health. So we're really focused on genomics and developing, like I said, new drugs and diagnostics that target or use the information in the DNA to help us essentially develop better medicine.
So you essentially followed a DNA trail to find Cryptococcus gottii?
Yeah, so in our infectious disease arm, we really look at the DNA of all these organisms, and there's a lot of secrets in the DNA that we're really learning how to uncover. And one of those is the kind of the molecular clock to learn how old an organism is, as well as how closely related it is to something else that maybe you find in a different part of the world.
So when you say the clock about how old an organism is, you mean like how long the species has existed?
Yeah, we can do that, or even how far two different organisms have separated. So if they're part of an outbreak, we can see these are really closely related. They've only separated in the last few weeks versus ones that are maybe a little bit older, several years to hundreds to thousands of years and so on. So it's almost like a carbon dating. By looking at the mutations in the DNA, we can get a pretty good estimate as to how old organisms are.
Wow, separations of a few weeks. So you really get to watch evolution essentially happen in front of you.
Well, and that's exactly what happens during a disease outbreak. That evolution is happening all around us. And yeah, now we have these really high resolution tools to watch that unfold.
So when did Cryptococcus gottii first begin to come to the attention of people in the Pacific Northwest?
It was really quite a surprise when cases were seen, both human cases and veterinarian cases were seen on Vancouver Island in 1999, and then shortly thereafter on the British Columbia mainland near Vancouver, and then a couple years later, cases starting to be seen in Washington and Oregon. So it's been about 20 years since the first cases were really identified that really established this as a new endemic disease in the Pacific Northwest.
And where, just for the record here, where does Cryptococcus gottii usually thrive?
Yeah, the surprise was that Cryptococcus gottii was really only thought to be found in the tropical, subtropical regions of the world, so down in the Amazon rainforest, also in Southeast Asia, and in some places in Australia as well. And so when it showed up in the Pacific Northwest, people were pretty surprised and concerned about why this would be moving into a new niche.
Well, let's talk about the concerns then. How does Cryptococcus gottii represent as a disease in humans?
Yeah, so that's a great question, is that this is an environmental fungus, so it's a microscopic fungus, you can't see it, usually lives in soil around decaying plant material, typically decaying trees or in the hollows of trees, and that's where it feeds on. If that gets, that fungus, it's a yeast, gets up into the air and you breathe it in, you can develop a pulmonary disease, like a pneumonia, and in many cases it can get worse, cause a very severe disease, and actually even escape the lungs and cause what we say disseminated disease, where it moves to other parts of the body, most importantly to the brain.
And yikes, what happens when it's in the brain?
Well, typically and this was fairly interesting with Cryptococcus gottii, it would cause a meningitis, so you know the kind of the stiffness of the neck, the headaches, but it was typically treatable and not highly fatal, this neurologic disease. When it started showing up in the Pacific Northwest, it seemed to be causing maybe a slightly different disease. There would still be those cases that would involve the neurologic symptoms, but there would all be very severe pneumonia and actually a fairly high fatality rate at the beginning because only the most serious cases were being identified.
And so it has caused several deaths already. Let's be clear on that, right?
It has, and it started off, the understanding was about a 30% fatality rate, and that was, again, because we're really only identifying the most severe cases until there was a good surveillance system in place. Now it is probably at 10% or lower. That's because we can identify more cases and more of the less severe cases, but also there's now better treatment, better understanding of how to deal with the disease. So we've been learning a lot, both on the medical side as well as on the public health side.
So I take a wild guess that on the medical side, they didn't know what they were dealing with in some of those earlier cases 20 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, that you would see these cryptococcus cases and treat it like you would hear about it in other parts of the world, or treat it like it was a different species of cryptococcus, and that may not have been the most appropriate approach. And so now there's better treatment guidelines out there, and we've definitely seen the overall case fatality rate dropping because of that.
David Engelthaler is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about the presence in the Northwest of what is usually a tropical and subtropical fungus, which can cause death, Cryptococcus gattii. We're talking about how it got here because he's got some interesting recent research that talks about acts of humans and of nature that got Cryptococcus gattii to this part of the world. Join the conversation on the Exchange. Questions and comments welcome at 800-838-3760 and jx@jeffnet.org. So often in the soil around decayed plant matter like decayed trees, well, there's an abundance of those in the Pacific Northwest. So is there a lot of C. gattii around?
What was surprising is that it did seem to be fairly widespread along the coastal forests of Vancouver Island and then the mainland of British Columbia, and then in parts of, say, Puget Sound and other parts of Washington. And then an additional finding really in multiple places in the Willamette Valley. And so it was very surprising that it was widespread and just kind of seemed to come out of nowhere. And I think that's really what brought the research community, the public health community, and the medical community together to figure out how on earth did this happen and how long has it been here? How did it get here?
Is it in any of the drier parts of Oregon or down into Northern California?
Yeah, what we typically see is it's really more either coastal forests or areas where that you see the Doug fir trees, the Douglas fir trees growing. And so that it doesn't have to be dense forest, but enough of the right environmental habitat and climate conditions to be able to support those types of trees, and that's where it seems to be showing. As you get down further into California, there has been Cryptococcus seen associated with coastal trees like the eucalyptus trees, and those were transplants originally out of Australia, and we think that may be a different scenario, that maybe that anything associated with the eucalyptus trees may have actually been transplanted from Australia, but that's a different strain than what has been seen in the larger Pacific Northwest area.
So once you got into doing your analysis through the processes you have at TGen, and apparently you discovered that the Cryptococcus gattii has been around for much longer than two decades in the Northwest?
Yeah, so some of the initial genomic techniques, the techniques looking at the DNA, some of the early techniques, was suggesting that there were three different strains that showed up in the Pacific Northwest, and that those strains were what we say is clonal, in that they're all identical to each other, and there wasn't any real evolution to say that they were there a long time. Once we started doing all of the DNA sequencing, and that's a pretty long genome, we're talking tens of millions of DNA letters that we had to decode, and once we did that, we saw a few more mutations that, once we put that molecular clock on that, it really suggested that it had been in the region for several dozen years, maybe going back 70 to 90 years ago.
Wow. So then you had to go on the trail and try to figure out how they got here. And one of the first things you looked at is ballast water. Is that right?
Yeah. So we knew that the fungus itself was most closely related to anything coming out of Brazil and out of the Amazon rainforest. So we had to figure out how did it really get out of maybe Brazil and up to the Pacific Northwest, looking at a number of different possible routes, how pathogens might move around. One of the ones that really struck us is that timing was not too far long after the opening of the Panama Canal, which was just a little over 100 years ago. And so now ships can move from Brazilian ports up to Western North America ports. And that would have allowed for transport of material. We didn't find any really good shipping manifest information to suggest there was a widespread contamination of the landscape by material that was brought up from Brazil, you know, like a lot of planting of trees and others, you know, like rubber plant trees or anything like that. But what we did start to understand is that those old sailing ships certainly took on a lot of ballast water in the ports and then would dump ballast water when they get to their new ports, but you know, and as they're offloading their materials. And so we know that ballast water contains microorganisms and even larger organisms as well, and has always been a cause of transporting things around the world. Once we also identified that this fungus seems to survive really well in ocean water, which was somewhat a surprise as well. It was started killing dolphins and seals and sea lions in the region. That it seemed to be a natural leap to go to understand that that would be probably the most likely way you could transport this fungus, if it's contaminating the ports in Brazil, up to the ports and contaminate the waters of the Pacific Northwest.
So it's not very temperature dependent, it seems like. It sounds like it does fine in colder water.
Actually, fungi typically will do better at cooler temperatures. So it's interesting that this fungus really likes the warmer temperate temperatures, and that's probably for a number of reasons and how it's adapted to the plants that live there and the climate type conditions. But they seem to do okay in colder temperatures, and so these particular strains seem to do really well and likely then surviving even in the cold waters, which is also, again, somewhat of a new understanding for this fungus. And then we had to figure out how on earth would it get out of the water and up into the forests.
And that got you to the tsunami of 1964, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. The 1964 Great Alaskan Earthquake, the largest earthquake ever recorded in Northern Hemisphere, 9.2 on the Richter scale, sent tsunamis throughout the entirety of the Pacific, especially along the coastline of Western North America. And something like that would push water, coastal water, up on land, up into coastal forests, like pretty much nothing else would be able to. And if the coastal water is containing these microorganisms, these fungi, here is now a natural way that the fungus could now widely contaminate the coastal forests in multiple areas of the Pacific Northwest and potentially even further south. Even pushed water up the Columbia River during these tsunamis. And then that leads us to thinking, well, how on earth would it really get all the way to the Willamette Valley? And we think that there's possibly some other natural disasters that actually may have helped that as well.
64 was a flood year, too, after the tsunami, wasn't it?
It was one of the largest flood years in the last couple hundred years for that region of Oregon, and flooded the entire valley. And we know that the ports are contaminated. The port of Portland certainly contaminated ships coming in and dropping ballast. So that's just a natural thing that happens with ports. We think that that amount of flooding would have allowed for mixing of the contaminants up onto land during that process. So that's these are definitely hypotheses, and what we're trying to do is understand what are the ramifications of this? What are the ways that we can test to either confirm this or refute it, which is what the research community has to do next.
David Engelthaler is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He's the principal author of recently published research indicating how the can-be deadly fungus Cryptococcus gattii got into the Pacific Northwest when it's generally known in the tropics and subtropics. He works at TGen, the Translational Genomics Research Institute in Arizona. You can join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. Now, the actual title of the research paper is On the Emergence of Cryptococcus gattii in the Pacific Northwest, Ballast Tanks, Tsunamis, and Black Swans. We got the ballast tanks and the tsunamis. How are black swans involved?
Yeah, so this fungus is not spread by birds, and so I don't want to make the impression that we think black swans were doing that. But black swan is actually a concept that's been developed in the financial world about that really important things that change the landscape that have tremendous effects are typically ones that cannot be foreseen. And it comes from the idea that all swans were thought to be white, and therefore a black swan would be a very rare thing until they started finding where black swans were, which is actually in Australia, by the way, interestingly enough, that we're saying here that the disease emergences are typically, they're really impactful, can have severe consequences, and usually not predictable when they're going to occur. And so we didn't, no one was looking for this. No one really had probably enough, I shouldn't say nobody had enough imagination, but I don't think collectively we had enough imagination to understand how pathogens can move around the world and cause new disease outbreaks and become a natural part of the landscape until actually after it happens.
Ah, so the imagination gets forced upon you by like, well, how, what is this doing here? And then you begin to backtrack and find the evidence.
That's correct. It's kind of it's like a detective story.
It is very much. So where do you go with the research next? I mean, where's the next place you take your detective skills?
Yeah. So with this story, we still want to confirm these things. So I think what we're hoping to do is set up a series of field tests where we can understand the impact of the tsunami and the flooding, and look at, you know, the water line and are some areas more contaminated, if you will, than other areas that would correspond to those the water lines from those events. We also want to understand. And another part of this hypothesis is what was the fungus doing for, you know, still a couple of decades? If that occurred in 64 and we didn't really see a lot of cases till 99, what was it doing in the meantime? And we have some other hypotheses about how amoeba, different organisms that survive in the soil, can actually harbor the fungus, and the fungus can then become potentially more virulent. There's been some laboratory work to show that that's true. I want to be able to get out and start to test, is this really what's happening in the Pacific Northwest as well?
So for the people who might have like already dove under the couch because they're afraid of taking a walk in the woods in the Willamette Valley, how concerned should anyone be about encountering C. gattii and getting infected with it?
I think probably not overly concerned about encountering. It's a natural part of the landscape, and there are relatively very few cases. So clearly people who get it, it's a serious disease, but there's really only a handful of cases being seen every year in Oregon. And so there's not a high risk. Your risk for pretty much everything else is much greater. But what's important for us is to better understand this pathogen as well as other pathogens. How do they move into a new place? How do they set up? How do they evolve to adapt? And we got to try to catch up to it. And we always try to be ahead of it, but I think we're always trying to catch up to these diseases and understanding them. So that's why we're spending a fair amount of time and energy still trying to understand this, even though there's still a very low level of disease occurring.
All right. Yeah, it just helps understand how things move about the world, and we have a better idea now. And can't wait to hear about the next phase of research coming out of TGen, the Translational Genomics Research Institute in Arizona, where David Engelthaler is the principal author of this research on Cryptococcus gattii showing up in the Pacific Northwest. David, thank you.
Of course. Thank you, Jeffrey. It's been good talking with you.
All right. Take care.